Jimmy Hinton grew up in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, just over a mile from where United 93 went down on 9/11. He's a faithful husband, father of three beautiful children, and a full-time minister. In 2011, he discovered that his father was a pedophile and that he had been for his entire adult life. Just as troubling to Jimmy was the fact that despite having 2 degrees and years of experience in ministry, nothing and no one had prepared him for the impact that this would have on his family, his church, and his community. In fact, even though over 90% of pedophiles identify themselves as religious, this is one topic that churches remain the most naive about. As a minister and founder of Church Protect, he works to bring this information front of mind. I met Jimmy about 3 years ago as I was beginning the Ezekiel 33 project. I saw an article on him in the Christian Chronicle, and I reached out to him. After conversing with him, I quickly realized that we were working towards the same goal. The only differences that we had primarily was a fact of distance, Texas versus Pennsylvania, and we just have a slightly different approach. We bounce ideas off of each other periodically, and we pray for each other regularly. Jimmy is uniquely qualified to speak on this topic because of his unique situation. He's a researcher and a minister. As a researcher, he lived under the roof of a pedophile for over 20 years. Most researchers get to interview pedophiles, but they have no idea if they're getting the truth whenever they're interviewing them. Jimmy's experience is far more detailed than any information a researcher could gather. And as a minister, he's aware of the intricacies that we have in the church. And he's also very keen on what our weaknesses are and how they can be exploited, along with the spiritual impact that such an event can have on those in the faith. Jimmy?
Thanks, Steve. Thank you all for being here today. No, it's not the most enjoyable subject, but I'm just encouraged and grateful that we have so many of you here to hear about this. So I'm going to share a little bit of my story, but that's not why I'm here. It's a gripping story. It's a horrible story. It's a powerful story, but that's not why I'm here. I typically don't tell much of my story just because it is so ugly. And it leaves people, quite frankly, a little bit depressed. I came on the backside of this, saying being haunted by how an entire family of 11 siblings. I'm number 6 of 11, so I'm right in the middle. How all of us missed this with my father. He preached where I preach now for 27 years. I went into ministry. I'm the only one of 11 kids that went into ministry, strictly because of my father's influence. So he was, by all definitions, a good father. Anytime there were ball games, he was there. He wasn't verbally abusive. He was kind, compassionate, caring. All the things that you would expect in a good, godly father in a good Christian home, we lived it. And so you can imagine when I found out in 2011 the identity crisis that I faced, as well as all of my siblings. How did we miss it? And what part of our childhood was real? And what part was fake? So a little bit more about myself. I co-founded Church Protect Incorporated not quite 3 years ago. My partner is John Mueller. John is a therapist. He has over 20 years experience working with survivors of child sexual abuse, and then he has 11 years working in prison with sex offenders, with the worst of the worst. He's counseled over slightly over 4,000 sex offenders. John knows his stuff really well. He has a couple degrees from biblical seminaries, so he is a Christian, and we share that in common. So I'm a full-time minister at the Somerset Church of Christ, where I grew up. I'm also an independent contractor for GRACE, Godly Response to Abuse in the Christian Environment. That's Billy Graham's grandson. He's the founder of that organization. And Boz called me up one day, and he had read an article that I wrote, and he had never met me. And he said, "Your level of expertise in this area is off the charts." And he said, "Where did you come from?" And I said, I gave him a little bit of my story, and he said, "Wow." And he said, "We'd like, if you're willing, to come onto our team as an independent contractor." So I helped them with a piloting program that we're just trying out, coming out of the final phases of that piloting program for a certification program for Grace. So I'm one of six certification specialists in the country. So what we do is we come with churches, we basically hold their hand through a 6-8 month period. And instead of coming in, doing a seminar on abuse and leaving, we actually work with them. We have a one-on-one, we have a person from that congregation. And so we work with them and help that person develop, get a team together to develop a policy. We give them required readings. It's a pretty vigorous program. Then, of course, another full-time job is husband and father. So last night I was telling Steve I slept 9 hours, and that was the first time in a very long time that this boy's gotten 9 hours of sleep. So a little bit of the story. In 2011, I'd been preaching for just over 2 years. I'm getting over a cold, so I'm going to be drinking a lot. That's not dirty water. I have lime in it. I'd been preaching for right about 2 years in Somerset, small congregation. It was on a Friday, July 29th, 2011. I got a phone call, and it was somebody who I know, somebody who's very dear to me. This young lady called me up, and she said, "I have something that I need to talk to you about. Can I come up and talk to you?" And I just knew by her tone that it was something very serious. And so I scheduled an appointment, and she came up, and she just came in, and she sat down, and her face was just red, and she, just looked incredibly stressed out. And she handed me a piece of paper, and she was shaking. And she handed me that piece of paper, and I sat down, and I started to read it. And it was an email that she had written to somebody else where both of them had been victimized when they were very young, sexually abused by my father. And, of course, I was just absolutely devastated to find it out through an email. And the way I describe it to people is it was a Holy Spirit moment, because I put the piece of paper down, and I looked at her, and I gave her what I believe were the three words that she absolutely had to hear in that moment. And I said, "I believe you." And I said, "I don't know what this is going to look like. I don't know what it's going to look like for my wife and I. I don't know what it's going to look like for our family, for my job, as a preacher. We may have to move out of state. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to sit here and I'm going to make you a promise right now. It stops now." That was on a Friday, an hour before I had to do a wedding rehearsal. So I went home. My wife came home from work. She looked at me and she said, "Well, you look terrible." And I said, "Yeah, there's a reason for that." And then I told her what I had just found out. And then I left for the wedding rehearsal. The next day, which was on Saturday, I did the wedding, which was for one of our church members, a very good friend of mine. I did the wedding. After the wedding, we're at the dinner and we're at this round table, and we had assigned seats. And so to the left was my wife. To the right was the young lady who disclosed. And across the table from us was my father. Yeah. So then on Sunday, I got up and I did what preachers do, and I went to work. I had to preach on Sunday with my dad sitting in the audience. He didn't know at that point that I knew. On Monday morning, my mom and I went to the police station, and we were sitting making a report on my father, not knowing how many victims he had. We had no idea what was going to unfold from this. He got contacted by the police. They brought him in for questioning. And the detective called me and she said, "Jimmy, it's really bad." She said, "There are 23 victims at this point that he confessed to." And she said, "The nature of the abuse," she said, "I've been doing this for years and years and years." She said, "This is the worst case that's ever come through this office." She said, "It's bad." She said, "Oh, and be expecting a phone call from your dad." He didn't know that I turned him in. So my phone rings, and it was him calling me to confide in me. He had something that he had to share with me and just had to get it off his chest. So I went over to his apartment, and I can't begin to describe what that was like as he started to detail what he had done to some of these kids and excuse it away and talk about how, well, if this were any other country, you know, this would be fine, but we live in this stupid country and America, and we have these dumb laws. And he said, I'm in trouble. He said, I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life. And I just played dumb, and I sat and listened to him. And so for the next couple weeks, Mom and I were divvying up siblings, and we literally made a list of siblings and decided which sibling would take it better from her and which siblings would take it better from me. And so we started calling and contacting. In the meantime, my dad, before he was arrested, there was about a two-week period where he was not arrested. He brought me out, and just like I'm talking to you now, just starts mentioning, oh, by the way, just so you know what you're left with, here are the victims from the church. And he just starts rattling off names of these little tiny kids that are in our congregation. My wife and I then had to take that information, and we said, if this were us, the first knock on that door that we wanted wouldn't be from police. We would want our minister to be the one to knock on the door and to tell us. And so I had the unfortunate displeasure of not only having to tell the family, but to tell them that the perpetrator was none other than my own father. And I tell people that was the longest 1 mile that I've ever driven. I used to drive truck. I have over 1 million miles under my belt. The longest mile I ever drove was from my house to their house, to tell them that all of their daughters had been sexually abused by my father. So, long story short, he ended up being arrested pretty quickly. He was put into prison 2012, 4 days before Father's Day. It was the same week of the Jerry Sandusky trial. So that was big. It was going on, which we were thankful for that because his story got buried 4 pages into the newspaper. Jerry Sandusky was at Penn State University. It was all front page on every newspaper. Every news organization was running the Jerry Sandusky story. Jerry Sandusky, ironically, is in Somerset right now. We have 2 state prisons in Somerset. Jerry's in Somerset. My dad is in Bellefonte, where Jerry Sandusky is from. The day that my dad got transferred from Camp Hill Prison, which is where it's a transition prison. So that's where you get your actual prison assignment. They put all prisoners at Camp Hill first. So the day that my dad was transferred from Camp Hill to Bellefonte, Jerry Sandusky went from Bellefonte to Camp Hill. He had just been arrested, and Jerry Sandusky was off to his transitionary prison. Just a lot of ironies in this. And so, this thing's really heavy. Sorry about that for the recording. So long story short, what happened was he got a 30 to 60 year prison sentence. So he will die in prison. It's a mandatory minimum. So he'll be 92 years old when he's first eligible for parole. Before you feel too sorry, he worked very hard to get that sentence. And in my opinion, that's not nearly the sentence for the crimes that he did. I maintained contact with my dad from the time he went into county jail up until now. I still maintain contact with him. And so people ask me, well, what's that like? What's your relationship like with him? My relationship with him is very different, very strange. And my number one primary goal is not maintaining contact with my father, but it's gathering information. I became a researcher of researchers because I was haunted by this. How did we all miss it? How did he do it? How did he get away with it? It blew my mind. When I started reading actual reports of what he had done to these kids and how often he had done it in the church building when he was preaching. He would molest kids in a bathroom. He would hide out in the baptistry. He would come out into the bathroom and molest kids in the bathroom, and then he would get up and he would preach seconds after he had molested children. How does somebody do that? And so Then I had this major, just complete trashing of my theology, because all of my theology was wrong. Because we always say, well, these wolves are, you know, they're really bad people, and, you know, it's the gang members. And I started reading my Bible for the first time and realizing that the devil works best in the churches, in broad daylight. And they're not hiding in the recesses of, you know, they're not sneaking off into the corners. They're doing this in broad daylight. And so John and I launched Church Protect, and we do a lot of consulting with churches. It is unreal, and this is no exaggeration, it is unreal how big of an epidemic this is in the church. This is every denomination. This is across the country, across the board. The amount of cases that we handle is unbelievable. And 85% of the churches that we consult with have as the abuser somebody who's in church leadership. Now wrap your mind around that for a little bit. We have elders, deacons, preachers, youth ministers, or somebody who's in a volunteer position, a non-paid leadership position at that church. 85% of the churches that we consult with have as the abuser somebody who's in church leadership. So these aren't people who are like, you know, disgruntled members and people who, you know, the church has kind of pushed them off to the margins. These are people who are highly respected. They're well known. They're polite. They're kind. They know their Bibles really well. They look like my father. So we do a lot of consulting. We do a lot of training. And I'm going to show you guys a little bit, because I kind of wrote in my little synopsis. I want to show you some of the tools to unlock the magician's code of how these guys work. Because at the end of the day, that's what I want to know. Right now, our current system for training churches or any organization is absolutely horrible. And it doesn't work. I'm here to tell you, as the son of a pedophile, it does not work. I promise you, it doesn't work. I can walk into any church that's been trained by any of the top organizations in the country, and I can exploit both the churches and the people, the building spaces and the people, within seconds. I want to know how predators think. I want to get behind their eyes, and I want to figure out, not behaviors, I want to figure out skill sets. What are the skill sets that they use? And I use an analogy, and I'll share this, and I think it'll make a little more sense. So right now, the current model is, let's teach red flag behaviors. Have you all heard that? Red flag behaviors. Okay. So red flag behaviors are, let's talk about some of the behaviors that these guys exhibit that are observable. And once you have so many of these red flag behaviors that get stacked up, then what's the option that we give them? And the only option? Report to police. My question is this. First of all, red flag behavior doesn't work, and I'll give you a demonstration why. Identifying red flag behavior doesn't work. Number two, why is the only option that we're giving people to report to police after the fact? And the threshold for reporting is reasonable suspicion. You have to have reasonable suspicion in order to report to the police. That means you can't go on a hunch. And I'll talk about that too. We need to reverse that. We need to be exactly going on our hunches. It's called intuition, and it works really well. But we tell people your only option is to report to police, whether it's child sexual abuse, whether it's rape, whether it's whatever it is, bullying at school. What's the only option we're giving kids? Is to what? Tell a teacher to report it. We don't teach them how to defend themselves. I love what you're doing. Steve and I connected right away when he told me about the Watchman Ministries. I'm like, holy cow, the first person I know of who's talking about prevention. Intervening before abuse happens. What a novel idea, isn't it? Right? Why aren't we intervening? Why aren't we teaching people, why aren't we teaching women when they're being groped by guys to knee them in areas that's going to drop them to the ground? Prevention. It's not okay. It's not okay for women to be handled like that. But we tell them, well, wait until it happens, and then you report it to police. It's insanity. And so we're doing the same thing in the training for pedophilia or any kind of sexual abuse. We're telling them, Well, your only option is to report once you have these red flag behaviors that have been identified. Here's why it doesn't work. I liken these guys a lot to magicians because this is how they work. After understanding my dad and really getting inside of his head, they work like a magician, which means everything, and I mean everything. And let me say that again in case you missed it. Everything is about skill set development. Practice, practice, practice. Dr. Gene Abel estimates, this guy's one of the leading authorities in the field of pedophilia in the nation. Dr. Gene Abel estimates that for every time a predator has a hands-on victim, that means he's actually molesting a child, every time that he's doing that, he has less than a 3% chance of getting caught. Every single time that somebody's molesting a child, they have less than a 3% chance of getting caught. I asked Dr. Anna Salter, who also is one of the leading experts in the nation. I emailed her and I said, well, do you agree with this statistic? She said, actually, I think Gene Abel's off. She's like, I think he's off by a little bit at least. She said, my experience is it's much lower than that. And to put that into perspective, my dad, who confessed to 23 victims, though we suspect he had hundreds, and that's not abusing a child one time, this is abusing each one of these children hundreds of times over a series of years. His victims, my dad's victims, all between the ages of 3 and 11. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times per victim, my dad operated at a 100% success rate. Never once were we on to him. Never once did we think, my goodness, I wonder if he's molesting children. The only reason he got caught is because a survivor, years after the fact, was bold enough to come forward and to report. It's the only reason he got caught. He would have continued to do this until the day he died successfully. How does that happen? So I tell people, either predators are the luckiest people on the face of the planet, and they should be buying up every lottery ticket that's out there, or there's something else at work. They're highly skilled at what they do. A magician never does their tricks. When they create new tricks, they don't get up on stage and perform it without practicing it. Why? You can speak out. Why do they practice their tricks? Yeah, to get good at them. Otherwise, what? What's going to happen? They're going to make mistakes. They're going to drop the card. They're going to do a coin toss or whatever, and they're going to mess it up. So they practice, 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 practice. So by the time these red flag behaviors appear, these guys have been molesting these kids for a very long time. And so, again, I can tell you, with a magician, I can give you red flag behaviors. I can tell you, they're going to use cheesy humor. They're going to have these jokes that, you know, they're pretty pathetic, but some of us with dry humor are going to laugh anyway. They're going to have a pretty assistant. She's probably going to be wearing a red dress. He's going to be wearing a cheesy black suit. There's going to be black in the background. He's going to walk into the audience, and he's going to play the audience a little bit. He's going to hand-select volunteers. I can tell you all that stuff that's red flag behavior. But here's my question. Does it tell you anything about how he did his trick? Not at all. The guy's still going to get up on stage, and I've told you nothing about how the guy does the trick. So this is where I came in, and I developed an assessment tool, and I'm going to present some of that this morning. And I'm going to show you that these guys have skills that they use, and I want to give you guys and equip you guys with some of that and show you twofold. One is how they get away with it, and the other is how we identify it. Because I want us to start seeing these predators, and this really works. This Thursday, somebody faces a judge, and I won't mention the state for my own protection. But this person faces a judge and will go to prison for the rest of his life. This person's been abusing little boys for decades, for over four decades. We have four who've committed suicide. Guy's been molesting little boys, likely in the hundreds. Very well known in the churches of Christ. Very respected. Many of you probably would know who I'm talking about if I said it. This tool that I developed is what outed him. Nobody had a clue. He was like my father. Nobody had a clue. I presented this at two different congregations, and all of a sudden, they were like, this guy hit on all 20 of them. And then shortly after that, some victims started coming forward. And now the guy faces a judge this Thursday. We need to get on the preventative side. And we need to step in and we need to say this isn't okay. So how do we do that? I'm going to show you a picture here. So just to give you a little bit of an idea. This was several years ago. That half face you see there is my father marrying my best friend who went to Harding here. That's me, because I was asked by my dad to read scripture while he did the wedding. That was the same year. That guy back there is me doing a wedding for my sister who's right there. Dr. Butterfield, you had Mandy in your classes. And that's my dad reading scripture because I asked him to read scripture for the wedding that I did. So I show you this to show you it's not these strained relationships. When we're asking people to turn in predators or to think that people are predators, this is what they look like. All right, I want to talk a little bit about sexually violent predators because John Euler and I started noticing a trend when we started consulting with churches across the country. Sexually violent predator. Sexually violent predator, the short initial abbreviation is SVP. So a sexually violent predator is a sex offender convicted of an Adam Walsh Act offense in Pennsylvania who has a mental abnormality or a personality disorder that makes the person likely to engage in predatory sexually violent offenses. Within 90 days of the date of conviction, the SOAB, that's the Sex Offender Assessment Board, must submit a written assessment recommending whether or not the individual should be classified as an SVP, based on numerous factors set forth in the law. The final determination as to whether someone should be classified as an SVP is made by the court after a sexually violent predator hearing. If an individual convicted of a Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3 offense is classified by the court as a sexually violent predator, the individual is automatically subjected to, so this is if somebody is an SVP, this is automatic. This just happens. Lifetime registration within the Pennsylvania State Police, within quarterly in-person verification of his registration information. Number two, lifetime, at least monthly, mandatory sex offender counseling with a treatment provider approved by the Sex Offender Assessment Board, and active community notification, whereby local law enforcement authorities notify neighbors, county children and youth agencies, local daycare centers, school districts, and institutions of higher education of the sexually violent predator's name, residential address, and offense, and also provide a photograph of the offender. Literally, the state police knock on doors. My wife is a preschool teacher at a daycare, and every so often, they get state police that knock on their door. They hand out a flyer with the predators. They say, we have a sexually violent predator who just moved half a mile away. Here's his picture. Here's his offenses. Here's what he did. They hand that to the daycare. They post it up all over the walls. My question is, why? Because they've been deemed by the Sex Offender Assessment Board, which knows what they're doing. They've been deemed by a judge who granted the SVP designation, and they've been granted by the prison system this designation. My father, you would never know this because as part of his plea deal, it was removed. My father is an SVP. He's a sexually violent predator, the worst of the worst. What we call them at Church Protect, we dub this name the child super predator. They're the worst of the worst. It's a classification of a pedophile, which pedophiles are bad enough, but these are people who will always produce more victims, period. Now, we saw an interesting trend when we started consulting with churches, and that's this. The people coming out of prison and walking into churches where churches swoon over these people because they found Jesus in prison are guess what classification of pedophiles? your SVPs. The vast majority of pedophiles that are coming out of prison and walking into churches and are saying, my goodness, I found Jesus in prison. Keep in mind, a lot of these were church leaders at one time prior to going to prison. Now all of a sudden they found Jesus in prison and they're walking into the churches. And so they call us up and they're like, man, we have this known predator in the church, but he's just the most wonderful guy. And he's so kind and he knows his Bible really well. And we want him to start having him teach Bible classes. And so the number one question that we get asked, number one question, hands down, that John and I get asked when we consult with churches is, how do we integrate this brother back into the life of the church? Number one question that we get asked. And we'll talk about that at the at the panel discussion. Steve and I will both talk about that. What do you do when a predator comes in your, a known predator comes into your congregation? So here's this tool that I developed back in 2015. And I'll give you a little bit of the background for why I created this. I'm just going to jump to the second paragraph. It's our hope that this tool can be used to spot predators more easily so that we can intervene before abuse takes place. It's time we start taking an active approach to protecting the innocent from sexual predators. It is important to note that abusers derive pleasure in harming children and fooling adults. Make no mistake, they don't wrestle with conscience like you and I do. Right? We struggle. And when we do something, there's this little annoying guy that sits on our shoulder. It's not the devil. It's our conscience. And we all hate the guy or gal, but it's that voice. Shouldn't be doing this. Shouldn't be doing this. What are you doing? What are you thinking? What have you done? You know, it's that voice, and we want to shut that thing off. And so there are a couple ways to make it right. One is to stop doing what you're doing, right? And repent. The other is to ignore the voice, but the pesky thing keeps coming back. And the other thing is to learn how to actively shut that voice off through conditioning. This is what's known, in the medical term for it is psychopathy. The true definition of a psychopath is somebody who has absolutely zero conscience. They're your bloody murderers. They're your rapists that you know, they'll rape and murder somebody. And then they'll smile. What was the guy's name? I try to forget these names. The shooter at the school or the church in Charleston that shot up the black church had, what was it?
Dylan Roof.
Yeah, Dylan Roof. If you see the pictures of Dylan Roof, you don't see contrition. You don't see this broken person. What's he doing in all the pictures? All the pictures, what's he doing? He's smiling. Now, some people are like, well, he has a mental disorder and he's blah, 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 blah. The guy's a psychopath. He's a legitimate, true textbook case of a psychopath. So you need to know that about these guys. There is no conscience. They're not wrestling. They're not like, my goodness, what have I done? And if you don't believe me, I had one of my dad's victims speak at a symposium, an abuse symposium that I did. This was back in July. She just had her 18th birthday, and she spoke brilliantly about how my dad abused her and how calculated and cold and often and grotesque it was. This was the family that my wife and I drove to their house and told their parents that all these kids had been abused. It's evil. Absolute, pure evil. So these people, they don't slip up. They don't fall into sin. We need to wipe that terminology out because it's just not the case. They're people who are, they're intentional, they're calculated, and committed. They're committed to abuse. So this, in a nutshell, this is my wrestling session that I charted out. I wrestled with Jesus a lot. I came across this passage in Matthew 7, which is down here. It's a little hard to see, but it's Matthew 7, 15 through 20. Jesus says this, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. you will recognize them by their fruits. That bugged me. I'm just going to let you know. Jesus knows it because I told him. That bugged me when I read that. You will recognize them by their fruits. Why? Because I was always taught, man, wolves in sheep's clothing, these people who come in, they don't produce fruit. It's not what Jesus says. They're producing fruit. And what annoyed me was Jesus said, you will recognize them by their fruit. Guess what? None of us in my family recognized. We didn't recognize my dad's fruits. None of us did. Then Jesus says, are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Now, it's interesting. Jesus doesn't say every tree that does not bear good fruit is given Bible studies and given us, you know, given all these chances, and you know, we coddle them and tell them how wonderful the love of Jesus is. Jesus is like, these people, in this context, wolves who come in masquerading as sheep. When they come in, they're cut down and they're thrown into the fire. Then Jesus repeats it, which really annoyed me. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. So John Euler, my co-founder, really came back to me and he's like, Jimmy, I want you to go back in time. He's like, because right now you are literally, and he said, I'm standing here to tell you, the only researcher in the country and possibly the world who's lived under the same roof as a pedophile. He's like, I've counseled 4,000 sex offenders. He's like, I don't really know what they look like in the home and in the community. I know what they look like in prison. I know what they look like in counseling sessions. I don't know what they look like out there when nobody knows that they're predators. He's like, I want you to go back in time and really think about what these fruits were that your dad was producing. So this bothered me. I lost a lot of sleep on this. I obsessed over this. And it was an unhealthy obsession. And so then, finally, slowly, I started thinking of some things. And I was like, okay, let me think about the times that I know my dad was gaining access to victims for the purpose of sexually offending them. And I went back and I started thinking about that. And I could think of a handful of occurrences in hindsight. And then I really got annoyed with Jesus because those times that my dad was gaining access, and I think you can appreciate this, not only were none of us being tipped off and being weirded out, it was the exact and total extreme opposite. He was getting accolades. He was getting praised. People were like, my goodness, when do you have time to babysit my kid? They were literally putting their kids into the lap of this wolf who was about to sexually offend them. He didn't even have to do the work. And so now I was really mad at Jesus. Right? And you can see why. And I'm like, Jesus, what are you doing? You'll recognize them by their fruits. First of all, I can't even see the fruits. And second of all, every time I think that he got access to the kids, he's getting pats on the shoulders and people are praising him. And then it struck me. It just hit me. It's like, he's producing fruit that look exactly like fruit that you and I produce, which is how they blend in so well. And on the outside, this fruit looks absolutely incredible. And it's not until you have the tools to dissect them and open them up and look at what's on the inside till we realize it's totally rotten on the inside. All of us have been consuming this fruit that the predators are producing, and we've been giving them thumbs up. And we've been praising them and applauding them. And my goodness, how much, look, we have comments like this. They're just like magnets. Kids just run to them. When I hear that now, that's the first thing. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do some digging on this person. And then I begin profiling. I know it's a term that people don't like, but I profile. You have to learn to be a master profiler. Jesus did it. Jesus told people to do it. Beware of false prophets who are wolves, ravenous wolves who devour these sheep. How are we going to do that? If we're saying, well, it's unfair to profile people, we shouldn't look at people that way. We need to know what's in people's hearts. And so I kind of mapped this out. I'm not going to have time to present this, but in a nutshell, this is the tree, so this is what we see on the outside. This is the facade. Down here, this grass, this is like the next layer of the facade. This is what they want us to see. And they work hard to create this facade. And so I wrote, this is what people see. Wicked people need to maintain a clean facade. To rupture this image is to expose the roots of the heart. And so as soon as people start poking into this facade and asking questions, the first response with predators is always anger. There's always rage just beneath the surface. I've written letters to my dad where I've poked into that facade, and it's so predictable in the letters that will come back. And my dad never had a temper, never raised his voice. He'll have letters where he'll just crucify me. Always followed the next day by a letter of apology. Anybody want to guess why? Because that facade was ruptured. He realized that I got into his head. And then he comes back and he apologizes. And he's like, sorry, I didn't mean to lose my cool. They're so used to having to maintain that facade. And if you can get that anger to come out of the surface, it's always in the heart. It's who they are. Jesus says, it's not the food that we put in that makes us unclean, but it's what comes out of the heart that makes us unclean. So what's just beneath the facade is the heart. So there are different levels to where they lay their roots down. So the first one is they don't honor God. They have a darkened heart. The theme is Romans. Romans chapter 1, verse 21. They exchange the image of God for other images. It's step one. God hands these people over. At some point, God washes his hands, and he just hands them over to their destruction. Why? He does it because God knows their heart. People get to a point where God washes his hands of them, and they've gotten that way because they want to be that way. It's willful decline into moral destruction. And then James talks about it. These roots start going down even deeper. They chase their own desire or curiosity. It begins with curiosity. And then that gives birth to sin. This is what James tells us. Sin is what I just called temptation in action. There's a big difference between temptation and sin. Temptation is what we think. Sin is what we do. Sin is temptation in action. And then there's the desire, which I actually had that crossed out, and I put the need for more. And then James said, sin, when it is full grown, leads to what? Leads to death. I don't think James means people are like, they keel over and they die. Just, unfortunately, I say that in jest, but predators outlive all of us. And there's theology behind that. They're the ones who sleep well at night. You ever notice victims of abuse? They don't sleep so well, do they? People ask, how does your dad sleep in prison? Quite well, actually. And I always ask the question, how do his victims sleep? Kyla, who spoke at my symposium, one of my dad's victims, she had told me privately before, she said, I average an hour of sleep a night. She said a lot of the times that he abused me was in my own home. And she said, in the place where I'm supposed to be able to lay down and go to sleep at night, she's like, I have flashbacks about your dad raping me. She's a prisoner in her own home. See, that's people going down a path of anxiety. People going down the path of ego, they sleep quite well at night. So I think what James is talking about here is it leads to this spiritual death. Get to a point where your heart is so hardened that you experience this spiritual death and you cannot repent. That is a biblical concept, by the way. The point of no return. Hebrews chapter 6, Hebrews chapter 10, 2 Timothy 3, 12 and 13. Paul says that evil people and imposters keep on going from what? Blank to blank. Bad to worse, that's right. Deceiving and being deceived. It's this downward spiral where they keep getting worse and worse and worse. Paul says, you have nothing to do with them. God hands them over to their destruction. There's a point where you step back and you say, these people aren't going to change. Okay, a note on persistence. Merriam-Webster defines persistence as continuing to do something or try to do something even though it is difficult or other people want you to stop. That'll preach. Continuing beyond the usual, expected, or normal time, not stopping or going away. So I wrote this note about it. Perpetrators are persistent in every aspect of their lives. People who live with them find themselves continually worn down, exhausted, and most often, and I would say most importantly, they don't know why. Persistence is what allows perpetrators to continue to gain access to hundreds of victims. Because of their persistence, they do not, will not, and cannot stop. They simply shift their focus to new victims. That's why they have such large numbers of victims. The average number of victims for a pedophile when they get caught is 150. That's the average. That's number of victims. That's number of individual children, 150 by the time they get caught. I said they simply shift their focus to new victims. It's precisely because of persistence that this tool works. Perpetrators hide many things, but their persistence gives us definitive actions that the people closest to the perpetrators can identify and monitor. Unlike many assessment tools out there, this is not one that can be cheated. It's not a checklist, but it's a series of patterns common to perpetrators. This is the skill sets that they're using. The word persistence appears on each description of the fruits as a continual reminder that persistent behavior is always a constant. That never changes. That will never change. It's as concrete as this floor that I'm standing on. Persistence will always be there, and it will manifest itself in different forms. That's actually good news for us because it makes it easier to identify them. And then a note on intuition, what Robert Thompson and many others, this is from Gavin De Becker's book, The Gift of Fear. I highly recommend it. He says, what Robert Thompson and many others want to dismiss as a coincidence or a gut feeling is in fact a cognitive process faster than we can recognize and far different from the familiar step-by-step thinking we rely on so willingly. We think conscious thought is somehow better when in fact intuition is soaring flight compared to the plotting of logic. Nature's greatest accomplishment is the human brain is never more efficient or invested than when its host is at risk. Then intuition is catapulted to another level entirely, a height at which it can accurately be called graceful, even miraculous. Intuition is the journey from A to Z without stopping at any other letter along the way. It's knowing without knowing why. So what we tell people is that we need to tap into intuition. What do we do at churches, especially in church culture? What do we do whenever people are predators are identified? What do? Well, we're going to have a meeting about that. We have an elders meeting in 2 months, right? Like, this is the world we live in, and this is the world we created. We have an elders meeting in 2 months. This kid doesn't have 2 minutes. Why are we talking about an elders meeting in 2 months when we need to be talking about right now? Right now, intuition is kicked up. We need to tap into that, which is awesome with the ministry that Steve does, the Watchman ministry. We need to be watchmen. We need to use intuition. Okay, I'm going to jump in and just give a couple of these fruits really quickly. There are 20 of them altogether, and we don't have a form for yet. We don't have a method yet for scoring this. So that we're going to be developing that where you can go online and you'll be able to start plugging things in, and we'll have questions, and depending on how you answer those questions, it's going to score the risk that these guys are, the potential that they are actual predators. So on the outside, education, it's a good thing, right? Let's teach our kids. We're all for that. Nod your head. Yes, right? Here's what's inside. The perpetrator is always going to describe this need to educate kids. Listen to the language. Language is important. I need to have a Bible study with this kid. I need to teach them this. I need to do this. They might have before or after church Bible studies with kids. Previous sentence. They find opportunities to instruct children. This is important alone. they'll never want other adults or other people to be in these quote-unquote Bible studies. That's a big no-no. In private, they'll teach them sex ed. For example, how to put on a bra, change underwear, kiss, perform sexually. The children will be forced to view pornography and perform sex acts. They'll become possessive. This is the predators. They become possessive of Bible studies. Anybody who interferes will only dismantle what the wolf has accomplished. They've so manipulated children that the children feel a need to be around and will defend the offender. The feelings are mixed. While there may be reluctance for the child, the perpetrator makes it fun enough that the child still wants to spend time with him, at least for a while. I know there's a class waiting here. What I'm going to do is, if anybody wants these emailed, I'll just flip through some of them so you can see them. Life skills. Images. The obsession of picture taking and posting pictures of kids on Facebook. Compliments. There's a difference between your kid is smart and things like what my dad would say, boy, she's really starting to bud, talking about a six-year-old kid. See, we need to look at the fruit and dissect it and see what's inside. What are the kinds of comments? The likes that they put on social media. What are these people liking? Personal time. Personal time with kids. So if anybody wants this emailed, you can contact me personally, and I'll be happy to email this out to you. I'm going to present some of these at the beginning of the next session, which starts in about 10 minutes. So sorry to rush through this so much, but in this room. Yeah. And then Steve and I are both sitting on a panel discussion that's just a continuation of this topic. And that's at, 2 o'clock? 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock today. And I don't know where it is. Okay. All right. Thank you guys again for being here.
Did you give one source of a solution for the victim?
One source for the solution for the victim. You mean people who've been victims? Yeah. So, okay. One source. Do you mean as far as something to do to help them?
Help them overcome.
Okay. One is believe in them, most important. Two is, and I think it's really not that complicated, you begin a ministry that's focused on survivors of abuse. There's a church in Morgantown, West Virginia, and this was kind of interesting. Somebody from that congregation had been to a lecture that I did, never talked to me, never bounced ideas off of me. They just started a ministry for survivors of abuse in their community. It grew so quickly within the first like 3-4 months that they were talking about starting a second carbon copy of that same ministry. They said, we just have too many survivors that are coming in from the community. It exploded. And it just, I assume it was probably a survivor of abuse who I don't know. But it wasn't rocket science. You know, they didn't do anything that was real difficult. But what that did is, it let the survivors know that this church is serious about listening to them and creating an environment for healing for survivors.